The following episode contains adult themes such as torture, dismemberment, domestic abuse, and mental illness. Listener discretion is advised, especially for listeners under 13. Natanael sat on the edge of his sweat-drenched bed, staring out the dark window. He knew he should sleep. He would need his strength in the morning, but it was impossible. Every time he shut his eyes, he saw the same apparition that had haunted his dreams since he was a child. Over and over again, the Sandman would appear to pluck out his eyes and feed them to his bird-beaked children. Sometimes the Sandman's visage would shift into the face of Coppelius, his father's diabolical partner, his father's murderer. Coppelius and the Sandman. The Sandman and Coppelius. Natanael was certain now that these two monsters were one and the same. And sometimes he saw the face of Lothair. Once his childhood best friend, Lothair was now just another enemy, perhaps even an agent of the Sandman. These thoughts chased themselves through his head until the night sky began to shift from black to inky blue. Natanael rose and crossed the room, gingerly lifting a rapier from on top of the dresser. As he drew the sword from its scabbard, the blade caught the first rays of dawn. It was time to put an end to all of this. It was time to kill Lothair. I'm Vanessa Richardson. You're listening to Tales, a Parcast original. Every Wednesday, we dive into the dark origins of another fairy tale. You can find all episodes of Tales and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Tales for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Tales in the search bar. The tales on this podcast are dark, sometimes scary, and full of adult themes. As a warning, the original story of the Sandman features terrifying nightmares, torture of children, body dismemberment, mental illness, domestic abuse, and suicide. Please exercise caution for children under 13. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. This week, we're completing our rendition of The Sandman, a Prussian-German fairy tale about a spectral being who terrorizes children who stay awake past their bedtime. Clara raced through the garden, tears streaming down her cheeks. She'd woken to the sounds of rapiers clashing in the distance and knew instantly what was happening. Her brother and her fiancé were in a duel to the death. She didn't know how it had come to this. Natanael had always been so kind and loving that she'd never thought him capable of harming a living thing. But there was a darkness in him too, an old hurt. When he was young, Natanael had been abused by his father's colleague, a man named Coppelius. He was severely traumatized by the experience and blamed Coppelius for his father's sudden and violent death. It was all so long ago, but recently the past had come back to haunt Natanael. He had become increasingly erratic, ranting nonsensically that Coppelius was a puppet master, controlling every element of his life. He seemed to believe that Coppelius was merely a disguise for the Sandman, a character from a children's bedtime story that Natanael had recurring nightmares about in his youth. He'd even decided that the Sandman and Coppelius were now disguising themselves in the form of an optician and seller of scientific instruments named Coppola. Clara had tried to understand. She'd tried to help Natanael through his madness, but he'd turned on her with such ferocity. She didn't know what would have happened if Lothair hadn't intervened. And now Lothair and Nathanael were going to kill one another. As Clara rounded a hedge, she saw them. Nathanael and Lothair's rapiers clashed as they dueled before the garden's small pond. Both men were clearly winded, their clothing drenched in sweat. On some level, Clara was surprised that the fight had lasted this long. Lothair was a skilled and disciplined fencer. Nathanael had never been the athletic type, and the sleepless nights and refusal to eat had left him gaunt and weak. But despite this, Nathanael was winning. He fought like an uncaged demon, swinging his blade over and over with reckless ferocity. He seemed to have no interest in protecting himself at all and left himself open in myriad ways. Lothair should have been able to turn this to his advantage at any moment, but he seemed so taken aback by Nathanael's rage that it was all he could do to defend himself. One look at Nathanael's wide, bloodshot eyes told Clara everything. In his mind, he was not fighting her brother. He was facing down every nightmare that had haunted him since he was a child. And he was truly fighting for his life.
Please!
The single word escaped Clara's lips. Nathanael faltered mid-swing, and as he glanced back at her, his face went slack. Clara knew. Through the haze of madness, Nathanael remembered their love. The interruption was all Lothair needed. He gathered his strength and pressed forward in a short burst, catching Nathanael by surprise. He swung his sword arm with all his might, punching Nathanael across the temple with the metal guard of his rapier. Nathanael crumpled instantly. For a glorious moment, Nathanael's mind was silent. There was nothing but darkness. Not the oppressive blackness from dreams where the Sandman stole his eyes, but a beautiful, peaceful darkness. Then, out of the darkness, Nathanael heard the most joyous laughter, the kind which could light up the gloomiest of days. He turned to see where it was coming from and saw his beloved Clara in the distance. She was reaching out to him with a smile that set his heart afloat. But a moment later, his heart sank. Another laugh had risen from the darkness behind him, the high, devilish cackle of Coppelius. Nathanael turned toward the sound to find a set of fiery red eyes piercing the darkness. The cackling grew louder, pausing only to ask a question in a gravelly voice.
Eyes? Have you brought me more eyes?
As Nathanael stared, Clara's voice rang in his ears.
I've missed you, Nathanael. Please come back to me.
Nathanael placed his palms against his temple as two voices echoed around him in the darkness. Clara's plea was like an anchor, pulling him to his knees. He wanted so badly to go to her, but how could he be worthy of her after what he had done? How could she forgive him after he had destroyed their relationship, after he had hurt her? He deserved no love. Only darkness. His eyes belonged to the Sandman. Then he felt her hand on the side of his face, brushing the tears from his cheek. Nathanael took a breath and turned to Clara, reaching for her hand, and the cackling laughter faded. As their hands touched, light flooded Nathanael's vision. He gasped and rolled to his knees. Clara knelt over him, her face pale with worry. Lothair loomed behind him, sword gripped tightly in his hand, ready to finish what he had started. Nathanael said,
I'm sorry. I've been so terribly, terribly wrong. I don't know what has become of me.
Lothair narrowed his eyes, but he allowed his blade to drop a few inches. Tears sprang to Nathanael's eyes as he continued. He told Clara about his vision and begged her not to give up on him. He had finally seen all the harm his obsession with Coppelius had caused. Clara's heart was torn in two. She had spent the night crying over her lost love, but now he stood before her, begging for another chance. She knew that she should not trust a man who had made her fear for her life, but as she looked down at him, she knew that she could not abandon the man she loved when he needed her the most. She turned to Lothair, eyes glistening, and nodded. Lothair lowered his sword and offered Nathanael his hand, pulling him to his feet. After the duel, Nathanael, Lothair, and Clara sat down together to officially mend their broken relationships. Nathanael apologized endlessly for his behavior. Clara and Lothair were still skeptical, but they agreed that he seemed sincere. They decided to give him a chance to prove himself. There were only a few days left before Nathanael was supposed to return to college. Clara questioned whether he was well enough, but both Nathanael and Lothair agreed that he should not abandon his education. Nathanael's last few days with his family were like a fantasy. His night terrors had vanished without a trace, and his sleeping mind was flooded with images of Clara. The couple spent their mornings in the gardens, chatting about cheerful nothings. In the afternoons, he played chess and discussed his college studies with Lothair. When it was time for Nathanael to return to college, there was not the slightest bit of ill will left amongst the three. As soon as he reached his dorm room, Nathanael settled into his desk chair to write Clara a letter. Before he had touched ink to parchment, he glanced out his window. His professor, Spallanzani, lived in the house next door. Normally the windows were covered, but on that day the shades were drawn and Nathanael could see into the house. Nathanael knew that Spallanzani had a daughter named Olympia, but he had never met her. Rumor had it she was either sick or mentally ill, or at the very least, terribly shy. Whatever the case, she never seemed to leave the house, and Spallanzani rarely mentioned her. Now, Nathanael could see Olympia's silhouette, sitting in the corner of what was clearly her bedroom. Though her features were obscured by the distance and poor lighting, she seemed unnervingly motionless. Nathanael watched her, waiting for her to move, until he began to wonder if she was watching him as well. It occurred to him that she had one of the finest figures he had ever laid eyes on. There was a knock at the door. Without bothering to ask who it was, Nathanael got up and opened it. In an instant, all the color drained from his face. Standing before him was the very embodiment of his nightmares. Coming up, Nathanael faces his greatest fear. Now back to the story. Nathanael stood in his doorway, staring out at the man in the hall. The optician, Coppola, grinned up at him. Nathanael felt as if he had been punched in the gut. Running into Coppola a few months earlier had marked the start of his journey into insanity. At the time, he'd been certain that Coppola was actually the evil Coppelius in disguise. Every instinct told him to slam the door in Coppola's face, but he remembered Clara's insistence that those fears were the product of a troubled imagination. He had to face them in order to see things clearly. Nathanael desperately wanted Clara to be right, so he allowed Coppola into his apartment. Keeping his voice as calm as possible, Nathanael informed the salesman that he had no need for a barometer and that he might find more luck next door. Coppola nodded knowingly and insisted that he had plenty of other things to sell, which were sure to interest even the most selective of buyers. Before Nathanael could respond, Coppola began to pull handfuls of eyeglasses from his jacket pockets and briefcase. As they piled up on his desk, Nathanael felt his heartbeat quicken. As he stared down at the glasses, hundreds of his own eyes stared back at him.
"Stop! Stop!"
Nathanael yelled, suddenly scooping up the spectacles and shoving them back at Coppola. "I apologize, but please get these out of my sight at once." Coppola laughed at Nathanael's outburst, but began to put away the glasses. Feeling foolish, Nathanael apologized and asked if there was something else he could purchase to make up for the man's troubles. Coppola didn't miss a beat. He giggled happily and began displaying various spy glasses. Nathanael picked up a delicate, pocket-sized telescope and raised it to his eye to feign interest. Perhaps by chance, or perhaps by the guidance of some nefarious, unseen power, Nathanael once again found himself looking into Olympia's bedroom. But whereas before he'd seen only her silhouette, he could now make out every little exquisite detail of her features. He had never seen anything so beautiful. Nathanael was awestruck, but as he studied her eyes, a slight chill ran up his spine. They seemed cold and lifeless, like the eyes of a doll. Nathanael was so enraptured that he did not notice the mischievous smile spreading across Coppola's face, nor did he notice the beam of soft light now emanating from the spyglass. It shot across the way to land on Olympia. Her eyelids fluttered suddenly, and they filled with a vivacious and enchanting glow. Coppola cleared his throat, causing Nathanael to jump. He'd almost forgotten the man was there. Coppola chuckled and reminded Nathanael that he must pay for the telescope. The embarrassed Nathanael paid him right away and bid him farewell. The moment the door was shut, Nathanael let out a sigh of relief. He could have sworn that the room had become brighter now that Coppola was gone, as if the man had taken some unseen darkness with him. He shook his head, angry with himself. "Don't start digging a hole," he thought. "You may never get out again." Nathanael sat back at his desk to continue his letter to Clara, but a moment later, he found himself reaching for the spyglass, then turning to study his enigmatic neighbor. But to his great disappointment, the curtains to Olympia's window had been closed. Over the following 3 days, her window shades remained down. Nathanael grew restless. Everywhere he went, he imagined Olympia. If he went on a walk, he envisioned her stepping out from the bushes to greet him. She even joined him in his dreams, sitting still and motionless, face coyly turned in his direction. A letter from Clara and Lothair arrived, and he placed it on his side table, unopened. Meanwhile, his letter to Clara sat unfinished on his desk. A week later, Nathanael learned that Professor Spallanzani was hosting a ball at his house, and all of his students were invited to attend. Rumor had it that for the first time ever, the professor's daughter would be joining in on the festivities. It would, in a small part, be Olympia's official introduction to society. Nathanael could not contain his excitement. On the day of the ball, he watched his neighbor's house with anticipation. He had gotten ready hours early and had to use every bit of his willpower to wait until an appropriate time to head over. Finally, carriages began to arrive. Nathanael counted them out, forcing himself to allow a crowd to form so there would be less pressure on him when he would finally get to meet Olympia. After the 10th carriage, he took a deep breath and made his way to the party. Spallanzani's house was swarming with guests, each one more brilliant than the next. But Nathaniel had no interest in making acquaintances. It didn't take him long to find Olympia. She was being escorted around by her father as he proudly introduced her to all of his associates. Nathaniel could not take his eyes off of her. She was ornately dressed and her face shone with excitement. Her waist was impossibly narrow, and the small of her back had an uncomfortable curve to it. But Nathaniel assumed it was the result of a tightly tied corset. She also appeared to have a slight stiffness to her stride, but that was explained away by the anxiety of attending her first social event. Eventually, Spallanzani led Olympia to the piano and announced that she would now perform for the guests. As she played and sang, Nathaniel found himself pushed to the back of the crowd. He removed his spyglass from his pocket and used it to get a better view. Olympia's fingers danced along the keys without hesitation, never missing a note, and her voice rang out in perfect pitch. It was breathtaking. As she played, Nathaniel began to believe that every single longing note was directed toward him. The melody on the keys pounded throughout his chest and sent his heart soaring. He lost himself so completely that when her performance reached its final ringing trill, Nathaniel cried out her name in delight. The entire room turned toward him and chuckled at his exuberance, but he was not bothered. Olympia was beaming at him, and she was all that mattered. After her performance, the guests began to dance. Nathaniel wanted nothing more than to dance with Olympia. Anxiety coursed through his body as he made his way across the room. Olympia was queen of the ball, and Nathaniel was certain she would have a long line of suitors waiting. Yet somehow, he found himself standing next to her before anyone else. He introduced himself and then reached out and took her hand. Olympia's hand was so cold and rigid, it sent a shiver coursing through Nathaniel's body. But as they locked eyes, he smiled. Passion burned through him as he put his arm around her waist and whirled her across the dance floor. Nathaniel normally considered himself a competent dancer, but next to Olympia, he had two left feet. Still, he never wanted to stop dancing with her. He didn't care how foolish he might look, so long as he could hold her in his arms. Twice throughout the evening, other men asked for a dance with Olympia. Nathaniel stepped aside begrudgingly, but was waiting eagerly whenever the song ended. When taking breaks from dancing, the pair sat side by side, holding hands. Nathaniel began to tell Olympia about himself. Once he started, he couldn't stop. He bore his heart and soul to the woman. Olympia was the perfect listener. She appeared completely enthralled by Nathaniel. Not once did she try to interrupt him, question him, or correct him. Instead, she politely agreed with him, simply sighing and saying, "Ah, ah," at regular intervals. As the night dragged on, Nathaniel barely noticed as the other guests began to leave. Eventually, Spallanzani passed by and informed him he was their final guest and it was time for his daughter to go to bed. Nathaniel apologized for keeping Olympia occupied for so long and asked if he could call on her in the days to come. Spallanzani found their interaction so intriguing that he agreed to their continued relationship. Nathaniel spent the next few weeks walking on air. He was constantly at Olympia's side. He dug up everything he had ever written and read to her for hours on end. Not once did she grow distracted or uninterested. Instead, she always eyed him and consoled him with her gentle, "Ah, ah," Nathanael was convinced that no one else had ever or could ever understand him like she did. Throughout this perfect fairy tale, Nathanael had but one thorn in his side. His fellow classmates did not understand how he could have fallen for Olympia. He often heard them whispering behind his back, claiming she was stiff and unintelligent, unable to hold the most basic of conversations. They felt she acted as if she were soulless, nothing more than a wind-up clockwork keeping perfect time. Nathanael shrugged off the concerns of his classmates by telling himself that they could not possibly understand. They had weak, unimaginative minds. Only Olympia had a mind equal to his, and only she could understand the love they shared. After a few short weeks of courtship, Nathanael went to Professor Spallanzani and asked him for Olympia's hand in marriage. Spallanzani was beside himself with glee and informed Nathanael that he would allow his daughter to exercise her own free will in the decision. Unable to wait a moment longer, Nathanael hurried back to his room and rooted through his drawers to find the ring his mother had given him. As he was searching, he came across a pile of unopened letters from Clara and Lothair. He threw the letters aside, pocketed the ring, and left in search of Olympia. While passing the threshold of Professor Spallanzani's house in search of Olympia, Nathanael grew distracted by the sound of an argument. Two men were screaming and banging around inside the professor's office. Thinking that something serious might be wrong, Nathanael hurried over to the room. He barged inside and froze in his tracks. The scene before him was almost too surreal to comprehend. Two men were fighting over a large object, pulling it back and forth as if in a game of tug-of-war. The man on the left was Professor Spallanzani, and the man on the right was the optician, Coppola. This on its own was not astonishing. Nathanael had known that the two men were acquaintances. What was truly strange was that the two men were wrestling over a stiff, female figure, like a life-size doll or mannequin. As Nathanael looked at its face, his eyes widened in terror. It was Olympia. Her wax face was as rigid as her lifeless body. And her eyes were gone. Through the gaping sockets, he could see a contraption of shifting cogs and gears. His beloved Olympia was no more than a clockwork automaton. Coming up, Nathanael grapples with this discovery. Now back to the story. After returning to his university, Nathanael had become infatuated with the daughter of one of his professors. He received permission to ask for her hand in marriage, but while he was on his way to propose, he encountered a horrifying sight. Professor Spallanzani and the enigmatic salesman Coppola were fighting over the stiff form of his beloved Olympia. Staring into her empty eye sockets, Nathanael realized that she was a lifeless, man-made robot. Spallanzani was yelling that she belonged to him because he had figured out how to make her work and had solved the problem of her eyes. Coppola insisted that her clockwork innards were the key component and she belonged to him. They pulled with all their might, neither one willing to give in. Suddenly, Coppelius screamed in a grating roar, "The eyes! Give me the eyes!" In an instant, Nathanael was a child in his father's study, staring up at the madman Coppelius as he gleefully demanded eyes. Hearing those same words now, Nathanael was certain that the voice was the same too. Coppola was Coppelius. Coppelius was the Sandman. He had haunted Nathaniel's dreams, tortured him, murdered his father, driven him to madness. And now he had Nathaniel's beloved Olympia in his grasp. With a wail of despair and horror, Nathaniel charged into the room. He didn't know what he was going to do. Olympia wasn't real. She was a clockwork robot. But he still couldn't bear the thought of Coppelius's disgusting, long fingers touching her. Before Nathaniel could even get close, Coppelius freed Olympia from Spallanzani and then lifted her into the air. Gripping her stiff form by the feet, he swung her entire body like a baseball bat and hit the professor across his chest. Spallanzani flew backward, sliding across his desk and falling to the ground, bringing a multitude of glass containers shattering to the floor along with him. Coppelius threw Olympia's body over his shoulder and ran from the room, knocking Nathaniel aside as he charged past. An instant later, Spallanzani cried out to Nathaniel for help. He was lying on the floor, covered in blood from numerous glass puncture wounds.
"Please, go after her," he implored. "She is my life's work, my best automaton. I have spent 20 years on every little detail, and now Coppelius has stolen her and left behind her eyes. Her poor eyes, take them to her."
The professor reached out and grabbed two eyeballs covered in blood and threw them at Nathaniel. In absolute horror, Nathaniel watched as the eyes bounced against his chest and rolled to the floor. Madness assaulted Nathaniel's mind. He screamed at the bloody professor, accusing him of working with the Sandman to steal his soul. Then Nathaniel leapt onto Spallanzani and wrapped his hands around his neck, squeezing mercilessly. Nathaniel was determined to choke the life out of Professor Spallanzani, but all the commotion had drawn attention to the office. Several of the students rushed in and tore Nathaniel off the professor. He flailed wildly as they wrestled him to the ground. Even then, he continued on like a madman, screaming and crying out in loud, guttural bellows. When the authorities arrived, Nathaniel was taken away to the insane asylum. The doctors kept him on a cocktail of medications designed to keep him docile, believing this to be the best course of action to ease his troubled mind. When Nathaniel's mother learned that her son was being kept in a near vegetative state, she hired a lawyer and managed to have him released into her custody. On the day Nathaniel's medicinal coma began to wear off, he felt like he was encased in a cozy bubble. His mind was so at peace that when he began to return to reality, he woke with a smile on his face. Clara was waiting at Nathaniel's bedside, and when he saw her, he cried out in joy. The pair embraced, and Nathaniel promised himself that he would never venture from her side again. While Nathaniel had been in the asylum, a distant uncle had passed away and left a large inheritance to his mother. She used it to purchase a house in the countryside. As a group, Nathaniel, his mother, Clara, and Lothair all agreed that it would be ideal for them all to move there together. They hoped a peaceful country atmosphere would help them all heal and recover. Despite the doctor's instructions, Nathaniel began to wean himself from his medications. He did not like how they dulled his mind, and he believed that he no longer needed them. His family was unaware of this decision and suspected nothing. He was generally upbeat and no longer tested their patience by wanting to talk about Coppelius or evil forces. One perfect and sunny day, the group decided to take a shopping trip to town. As the evening drew to a close and they were strolling through the town square, Clara noticed the clock tower and decided she would like to climb to the top. Their mother was tired, so she declined the opportunity and had a servant take her back home. Lothair was willing to wait for them, but he didn't feel like climbing up the stairs, so he sat down on a nearby bench. The two lovers, Clara and Nathaniel, made their way to the top of the tower on their own. The view at the top was breathtaking. Nathaniel pulled Clara close to his side as they looked out over the city. The sunset was spreading pastel pinks and oranges across the sky. Clara tilted her head up to Nathaniel, told him she loved him, and planted a quick kiss on his cheek. Nathaniel grinned as he soaked in the view. But his peace did not last long. A sense of sudden, terrible foreboding took hold in his soul. Somewhere in the crowd below, he was certain he had glimpsed the face of Coppelius. Nathaniel released Clara from his grip and took a quick step away from the window ledge. Grasping the railing at his side, he focused on his breathing. He told himself it couldn't be Coppelius. It was just his illness, once again rearing its head. He hoped that was true, but he needed to be certain. So Nathaniel reached into his pocket and grabbed his old spyglass. As he raised the spyglass to his eye, Clara stepped to the side, accidentally obscuring his view. Nathaniel gaped in astonishment. Through the lens of the telescope, Clara's face had transformed into the hideous visage of a monster. Nathaniel screamed in horror.
"I knew it! I knew it all along! You are a monster, possessed by Coppelius and sent to torment me!"
Clara gasped in shock and tried to slowly slide away from him, but he was quick and he lunged forward, grabbing her by the shoulders. Clara was filled with dread as she looked into Nathaniel's eyes. The man she loved was gone. His face was contorted into madness, and rage radiated from his piercing stare. She cried out for help as Nathaniel began to force her toward the edge of the overlook. Clara fought with Nathaniel every step of the way, but the ferocity she'd seen in his fight with Lothair had returned. Soon they had reached the window next to the giant clock face. Nathaniel kept coming, clearly trying to shove her through the opening. Clara wrapped her arms around the guardrail and held on with all of her might while begging him to stop. But it was as if Nathaniel were staring straight through her. He snarled that he had to do this. He had to rid himself of Coppelius's torment once and for all. Just as Clara was about to lose her grip and fall to her death, Lothair burst into the clock room. Clara gasped in relief as Lothair tore her from Nathaniel's grip, then grabbed Nathaniel and flung him across the room. He swept Clara into his arms and raced from the room, carrying her down the stairwell as quickly as he could possibly move. She buried her face into her brother's shoulder, weeping as he whisked her away from the man she both loved and feared. As they reached the bottom of the stairwell, Lothair gently set Clara down on her own feet. She could still hear Nathaniel's voice faintly echoing above them. He was ranting and raving that all the world had united against him. Everyone was in on the Sandman's diabolical scheme. Clara's skin crawled with dread. She pulled away from Lothair and rushed out the door. She looked up, shielding her eyes with her hands as she searched for Nathaniel at the top of the tower. He had his spyglass raised to his eyes, and he was studying something behind her. Clara turned to search the growing crowd, wondering if she could figure out what he was so enthralled by. Then Nathanael began to scream again. He called out, "You fiend! You monster! You've haunted my every step, and now you leave me with but one option for escape. I must go where you cannot follow, and where your influence holds no power. Behold, the Sandman has come." Clara shrieked in horror as Nathanael jumped from the window. He tumbled through the air for the most terrible instant, and then hit the cobblestone ground of the square with a sickening thud. Clara spun away from the sight, clasping her hands over her mouth to stifle her sob of grief. The motion was so abrupt, she knocked into the man standing behind her. She reflexively began to stammer an apology until she froze mid-thought, distracted by the man's enormous, hairy hands. Her eyes traveled from the man's hands to his face. He had a jutting chin, a strong forehead, and a large bird-beaked nose. It was a face she'd never seen but had heard described in vivid detail over and over again during Nathanael's ravings. Coppelius. Clara silently mouthed the name. The man didn't seem to notice and brushed past without the slightest acknowledgement. He knelt for a moment at Nathaniel's side, grinned menacingly, and then stood and faded into the crowd. The authorities had finally arrived and soon began pushing onlookers back away from Nathaniel's body. Clara finally forced herself to look. She instantly regretted it. His body was broken in nearly every way imaginable. His limbs twisted impossibly. His skull cracked open. But worst of all were his eyes. They were gone. E.T.A. Hoffman's 1816 short story, The Sandman, is a twisted, often difficult tale with a plot that's rife with ambiguities. The tragic ending leaves more questions than answers. Is Coppola truly Coppelius, as Nathanael so adamantly believed? Did Coppelius murder Nathanael's father? Is the Sandman real at all, or merely the creation of a young, frightened mind? Are all of these merely the delusions of the madman, or is there something more sinister and possibly supernatural afoot? In his 1906 essay, On the Psychology of the Uncanny, German psychiatrist Ernest Jentsch suggests that the answers to these questions are less important than the mood and atmosphere the questions themselves create. He calls this effect the uncanny, which he describes as an intellectual uncertainty created when a reader or audience is forced to walk a narrow line between the known and the unknown, the strange and the familiar, the hostile and the safe. In The Sandman and his other works, Hoffman regularly blends a realistic narrative voice with the strange and surreal in order to create such an effect. His tales often sought to shine a light on the wicked aspects of human nature, symbolized in the characters of Coppelius, Coppola, and The Sandman. Time and again, these characters enter Nathaniel's life at the point when he's close to achieving some level of personal growth or happiness. In this way, they represent his own moral shortcomings and the fears and traumas from his childhood that keep him from becoming a better man. The tale also explores the complex nature of abusive relationships. It's easy to sympathize with Nathaniel because of his childhood trauma up until the point when he begins traumatizing others. The ending makes it clear that Clara should have abandoned the relationship after the first instance of abuse. But as futile as it is, her decision to stay with him and fight for the relationship is presented as understandable, even heroic. But as Hoffman shows, love is rarely enough to fix a broken mind. By the ending, Nathaniel's view of reality has become so warped that he's incapable of loving Clara or of protecting her from himself. Hoffman's interest in psychoanalysis and human behavior can be read in his treatment of its eponymous villain. Outside of his short story, the character of the Sandman was historically almost always presented as a benign and helpful figure, an elf who helped give children a restful night full of sweet dreams. By turning him into a demonic fiend, Hoffman is taking a symbol of domesticity and childhood and making it monstrous. Just as fear turns Nathaniel from an innocent child into a monstrous version of himself. It's a shame that Nathaniel spent his entire life being haunted by a figure that brought peace and comfort to others, but he could not escape his trauma, nor could he dispel his nightmares. Both were always fated to return each night when the Sandman arrived. Thanks for listening to Tales. We'll be back Wednesday with a new episode. You can find more episodes of Tales and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Tales, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Tales on Spotify, just open the app, tap Browse, and type Tales in the search bar. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. Join me next week for another dark and surprising fairy tale. Tales was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Carrie Murphy, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Isabella Way. This episode of Tales was written by Amanda Hobseth, with writing assistance by Greg Castro. I'm Vanessa Richardson.